Okay, hello and welcome to the Idea Pod, which is a podcast for examining ethical issues in applied ethics and bioethics and a range of other topics. Brought to you by the Idea Centre, which is a centre for applied ethics here at the University of Leeds. My name's Tom Hancocks. I'm a lecturer and consultant at the Idea Centre. And this week, I have the pleasure of being joined by one of our past alumni, Georgina James.
Hello.
Hello, Georgina.
Hi.
So Georgina was on the MA in healthcare ethics. And Georgina wrote a very well-received, an excellent dissertation, which was on the topic of reproductive rights around addicts, and in particular addressing the issue of whether it's permissible to incentivize the sterilization of addicts. So this podcast is going to be asking Georgina a little bit about her research and some of the main conclusions and arguments that she developed within it. So hello, Georgina. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's okay.
Georgina, your research project was called Project Prevention, Paid Prophylaxis or an Attack on Autonomy. Please could you say a little bit about what your research was about?
Yeah, of course. So my research was looking at an organisation called Project Prevention, which is a US organisation which pays drug and alcohol addicts $300 to use long-acting contraception or to be sterilised, therefore effectively preventing them from having children. And throughout my dissertation and my research, I was examining the morality of this kind of organisation and exploring the impact that it has on the drug addicts' autonomy and their reproductive rights.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. And what was it that inspired you to engage in your master's research in this area?
Well, I've always been quite interested in reproductive and sexual health and the sort of ethical issues which arise when one person's decision directly impacts another, as a mother's does on her children or her potential children, and how this sort of sits with the concept of personal autonomy and all the other factors that come into that. But I first came across the sort of concept of paying people to limit their procreation on an episode of BBC Radio 4's Inside the Ethics Committee, which discussed providing cash incentives to homeless women who are also often addicted to drugs when they had a contraceptive implant inserted. And I found this sort of dichotomy between valuing the woman's autonomy, acting in their best interests, preventing harm to them, and also preventing harm to their children and the rest of society, really interesting, but also quite challenging. And so I did a bit more research into this sort of area and came across Project Prevention and was keen to sort of explore that a bit further.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. So I think you mentioned that Project Prevention is a project that's mainly based in the US. And has some traction there. Did you find that it was likely that it something like Project Prevention might come into existence in the UK?
Yeah, so it's certainly possible, and that was actually one of the main drivers for my research into this scheme, because although starting in the US, Project Prevention's actually been operating in the UK since 2010, but here they've been limited to paying drug addicts to use long-acting contraception rather than to be permanently sterilised. And they say on their website that the British Medical Association currently makes it too difficult for them to pay addicts for their sterilisation. But they do actively encourage their supporters and their proponents to petition the BMA to change this policy. And considering that the scheme is entirely donor funded and actually receives considerable support from people in well-respected positions, including some medical professionals and midwives, I do think that there is a genuine potential that if this support continues, Project Prevention UK could become as extensive as it is in the US.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned briefly there that there's different ways of going about sterilization and probably different definitions of what sterilization is or different types of sterilization. Could you say a little bit about what you mean by sterilization?
Yeah, so that's a really good point, actually, because when I say sterilization, I mean a permanent method of contraception which irreversibly prevents a pregnancy. So in men, this can be in the form of a vasectomy, and in females, this is often in the form of a tubal occlusion. So it prevents either the man or the woman ever having a child. So that's different to the long-acting contraception, which are sort of contraceptive methods which just require admission maybe less than once a month and prevent pregnancy for extended periods of time, but are essentially reversible. So it's the long-acting methods that Project Prevention are paying addicts to use in the UK, and it's the sterilisation and the long-acting that are being incentivised in the US.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a good point to clarify. Just one question I had was whether you, when you first approached the topic, you mentioned that you listened to some things on the BBC and that was part of the motivation, but also that you've had a sort of interest in the area prior to that about female reproductive rights and issues around that. When you first approached the topic of the incentivization of sterilization, did you have any kind of intuition, initial gut feelings about what might be acceptable or what might not be acceptable?
Yeah, so I think my initial thought when I first came across the idea was that I found it quite shocking, actually. I think just because maybe bringing my own sort of biases and interests, I've always sort of thought of reproduction as something quite important and something quite sort of fundamental to us and what makes us sort of human, and I feel like it's a big part of our lives. So I think when I originally came across it, I did feel quite shocked that that was a possibility.
Yeah. So your initial sense was that it was probably wrong?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And did that intuition, was that a key part of your thesis? Did that intuition stay as you were making your arguments?
Yeah, it did really. So I think throughout my research, there were lots of challenges that came up that made me think, oh, well, it might be wrong to pay people to not have children, but is it as wrong as, say, allowing children to be born addicted to drugs? I was challenged in that way, but I think I eventually came to the conclusion that it was wrong, no matter what the sort of other consequences of allowing these drug addicts to reproduce was.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the central parts of your argument is the idea that it is the issue of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And the concern that if you incentivize sterilization, that can have a sort of corrosive impact on the autonomy of the addict. Could you say a little bit more about that argument?
Yeah, so the addict's autonomy and the importance of autonomy was really central to my thesis, and sort of originally, I've spent quite a lot of time exploring what autonomy was and what I sort of took it to mean. And I found it quite difficult originally to get quite a clear concept of what's necessary for autonomy and how is it undermined and how does it sort of exist as a concept, because much of the sort of literature either focused on internalist or externalist views of autonomy, and neither of which I found completely satisfactory. So I ended up advocating a socio-relational account of autonomy, which sort of gives four conditions that are individually necessary and together sufficient for autonomy. And I then assessed Project Prevention's scheme of incentivising sterilisation against this sort of criteria, and found that it basically made these addicts incapable of making autonomous reproductive decisions.
Yeah. Okay. And what was it that you found appealing about this socio-relational idea of autonomy?
So I found this idea convincing because it incorporates the idea that there's something within us, within our internal psyche, a sort of, I think Osana says, a capacity for critical reflection that's necessary for autonomy. But also accepts that there are some external factors which can impact our autonomy, such as influences which might jeopardise our psychological integrity, such as manipulation and coercion. And it also takes account of some socio-relational properties, such as the kind of social conditions that we're exposed to. And considering that addicts are often really disproportionately affected by the kind of social conditions which can be debilitating to autonomy, I thought that this was a really good criteria to apply to them.
Yeah. You mentioned this aspect of critical reflection.
Yeah.
I think one of the really interesting parts of your thesis is the way in which, well, firstly, that critical reflection is really important for our autonomous decision making, but also secondly, that addiction can have a really debilitating effect on our ability to critically reflect about things, and obviously that's one of the features of what's bad about addiction. Could you say a bit more about how addiction impacts on critical reflection and how that relates to autonomy?
Yes, so one of the things that I found was necessary for autonomous critical reflection was the idea that we can have lots of these competing interests and desires and in our brain. So we might desire lots of different things which can compete and possibly conflict, but we become autonomous and can make autonomous decisions when we can unify these and make decisions which are extended over time and reflect our unification of these interests and reflect and extended our extended will. But the nature of addiction and the way it affects people's brains mean that addicts are prone to experiencing extremely sharp preference reversals. So it's actually really common for an addict to state and genuinely desire that they don't want to take drugs or that they weren't addicted, but also have this coexisting genuine desire to consume drugs, and they exhibit this inability to unify these desires to consistently extend their will across time, and therefore fail this critical reflection and internal psyche criteria which is necessary for autonomy.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Did you think, while you were doing your research, did you think that there was any way in which you could design a scheme that was similar to Project Prevention, which, you know, involved the incentivization of sterilization? Was there any way that you could design that in a way that would respect or enhance autonomy? Or did you feel that it was just destined to never work on autonomy grounds?
Yeah, so that's interesting. It's something I did consider quite a lot. But I think the conclusion I came to is that the crucial combination of an addict's diminished capacity to make autonomous decisions and the fact that incentivizing their sterilization maximizes on this and further undermines it means that when there are incentives offered to drug addicts to be sterilised, I don't think that there is a way that that can ever be ethically permissible. And I think there might be schemes that could be designed to benefit addicts, definitely. But I think a better way for a sort of more beneficial scheme to spend this $300 might be, it would be better spending providing addicts with rehabilitation or preventing addiction to prevent the sort of vulnerability to having their autonomy undermined in the first place. I don't think that incentivizing sterilization and therefore maximizing on their on addicts' diminished autonomy can ever be permissible.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. So we've mentioned this central argument of autonomy, and obviously that's one of the key parts of your argument. But there are other aspects to your argument as well. And one of the key points that you make, or rather one of the key arguments that you challenge, is this idea that incentivizing sterilization might be a good thing because it prevents harm to children soon to be born children. Could you say a little bit more about that argument and why you don't think it works?
Yeah. So you're right. So Project Prevention give preventing child suffering as their one of their primary motivations for their scheme. And sort of implicit in this claim is the idea that the children of drug addicts would be better off not being born than being subject to the adversities that come with parental addiction. And this kind of claim is quite similar to those seen in legal wrongful life claims, where an infant claims damages against their parents for allowing them to come into existence, given that it was known or should have been known that their existence would be severely afflicted. But I took sort of a stance that this couldn't be applied to the addicts of the children addicts, and used Feinberg's concept of what constitutes such a wrongful life to argue this. So I think it's important to realise I'm not disputing that addicts' children aren't harmed in one sense, in that their interests might be negatively affected by their parents' addiction. But I argue that they're not harmed in the sense which constitutes a wrongful life, because by being brought into existence, their rights haven't been violated. And for a life to be truly wrongful, Feinberg states that it must be rational to prefer non-existence than to prefer that life. And these children's life, although they experience quite a lot of adversities, as long as their lives are minimally worth living, it cannot be said that their lives are wrongful, because they've not been harmed in the sort of morally relevant sense that constitutes a wrongful life. And I take the stance that the lives of addicts' children are in the very least minimally worth living. Like, the NSPCC estimates that 1 in 7 infants live with a substance misusing parent. And I think the suggestion that the non-existence of this many children is preferable is really quite uncomfortable and implausible enough to reject it.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And I think, as you say, you know, the motivation that Project Prevention give is to prevent suffering to children, but actually that it also almost seems that that's an unexamined assumption, that they just assume that children born of addicts will always necessarily be in a state of suffering.
Yeah,
but actually, exactly. By challenging that, you're making the really important point that we can't just assume that. You know, children of addicts do go on to live flourishing lives and go on to be, you know, very successful and happy people. So that basic assumption of Project Prevention seems really questionable.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely true. And I think even if people have an issue with that and say, well, these children do experience awful lives and they do experience adversities, which is true, like there are real issues that do come with being with addiction, that doesn't necessarily mean that their lives are wrongful or that they would be better off not being born. And it's that sort of distinction that I think was quite important.
Yeah. And I suppose it is part of the challenge that it's very difficult to generalize for all children of addicts, that you know, it may be the case that generally addiction will, you know, tend towards having kids who will live difficult lives. It doesn't necessarily follow that from addiction that all children's lives will be awful. It's probably more of a case by case.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think it's a really important challenge to the sort of motivation of protection. Another really important challenge that you make is against this argument that incentivizing sterilization is a good thing because it is of benefit to the addicts themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could say a little bit about that argument and why you think that it doesn't work.
Yeah, so that argument sort of, I was doing my research, it sort of seemed to arise from times where people have challenged Project Prevention and said to like the founder, I don't think that this is a good thing that you're doing. It's not good for the women. And they'd come back and say, oh, actually it is, because it means that they don't experience the financial burden of having children and the emotional and physical burden of pregnancy and everything. So it's essentially claiming that it benefits these female addicts. But my main problem with this claim was that I believe it demonstrates a misconception of what it means to truly benefit somebody, and think that interventions which aim or claim to benefit people need to benefit them according to their own standards, the individual's own standards, rather than according to some of their own predetermined measure. And at no point does Project Prevention's incentivized sterilization make an effort to elicit the addict's own conception of the good, and they don't prioritize it either. So nudging the addicts towards choosing sterilization and then paying them $300 to do so doesn't necessarily reflect the choices that these addicts might have made if they were free from the burdens of addiction, which limit their ability to make autonomous choices. And it doesn't, like we said about generalizing the what's good for the children, it definitely generalizes what's good for the addict. What's good for one addict might not be good for another person, because their addiction doesn't take away the fact that these are individual people with individual conceptions of what is good for them and individual priorities.
Yeah. Did you find that, I suppose one way of reading the problem of giving someone $300 to, you know, incentivize their sterilization is when that person's an addict, it's pretty clear what they're going to be doing with that $300. And it's not going to be, you know, buying books or healthy food necessarily. It's going to be probably buying more drugs. So did you find that that was part of the problem? Is $300 seems to just probably keep them in a state of addiction or facilitate keeping them in a state of addiction?
Yeah, definitely. So I think it really does contribute to that sort of vicious cycle. And like, so the research I found showed that the $300 would be highly likely to enable and increase the purchase of drugs, like you said, likely increasing consumption and exacerbating the inability for the critical reflection, further undermining autonomy. It also, this incentive can be seen to undermine autonomy in a different way as well. And we can sometimes think about incentives tipping over to become inducements. And that happens when they have such characteristics that distort people's judgments about decisions they're making and cause an underestimation of the risks and an overestimation of the benefits. And as the $300 Project Prevention are providing is more than most addicts could easily access, I think I argue that it can be said to be this sort of inducement. And another part of addiction is that addicts are quite likely to exhibit high levels of something called hyperbolic discounting, which is a phenomenon seen in normal humans. When I say normal, I mean humans who are not addicted to drugs, where we overvalue goods when they become immediately available to us. So even if we consistently prefer X to Y, when Y becomes imminently available, we're much more likely to just go for it and take that option. And this has seemed to a really high extreme in addicts. And as the $300 would make these drugs imminently available to them, incentivizing sterilization further feeds into increasing their access to drugs and feeding their addiction even more in that, by exploiting these tendencies of addiction.
Yeah. Do you think, or did you think while you're doing the research, that the amount of money makes a difference? So imagine that, for instance, they were paid $3,000 or $30,000, would that make any difference, do you think?
I think that is quite interesting. I think that the amount of money wouldn't change the amount that autonomy is undermined, considering the nature of addiction and the characteristics we've discussed. But I think that as it wouldn't change the fact that autonomy is undermined, I think I'd have to say that it doesn't make it any better, because another key part of my argument is that autonomy is intrinsically valuable.
Yeah.
Because it's very connected to our personhood, and it's essential and it's valuable in itself, not just for the benefits it confers. So even if we say, okay, addicts might not have autonomy, but at least they have $30,000, I don't think that that takes away from the wrongness of undermining this intrinsically valuable concept.
Yeah. I think that it's a really interesting point. I think it leads nicely on to the next question that I wanted to ask, which is another really important part of your argument, which is probably something that people perhaps think less about in this area, is this idea of the commodification of reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the challenges you raise to this idea that you can, in effect, put a price on someone's reproductive rights or reproductive capacity. You challenge that idea because it represents putting a price on something that fundamentally there shouldn't be a price put on.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could say much a little bit more about this idea of commodification and why you think it's problematic in this context.
Yeah, sure. So I first came across this idea when I was reading some of the political philosopher Michael Sandel's work, and he suggests that by attaching a monetary value to a good or a concept, we imply that it's appropriate to treat that thing as an instrument for profit or for use. And then he argues that not everything can be properly valued in this way. And I believe that reproduction and reproductive rights is a perfect example of this, because our reproduction and reproductive rights are fundamentally tied to our personhood in the same way that our intrinsic organs are, and our organs are valuable. So ascribing them a monetary value cheapens them and fails to properly value them. Another thing that I found really interesting was the idea that the commodified and non-commodified versions of some things can't exist at the same time. So once we commodify something, it will eventually become void of its intrinsic value. So if we commodify the addict's reproductive capacities, eventually we will make these capacities void of their intrinsic value and encourage society to see these people as beings with reproductive capacity rather than as whole persons, and I think that seems like a good enough reason to preclude doing so.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point, and I think obviously Sandel's work is really sort of topical in many ways, and I think you apply it really well to this topic. But you know, it's in the world we live in, where you can buy pretty much anything off the internet, including, you know, love, friendship, and all of these other things that people find intrinsically valuable. Yeah. I think you apply that argument really well to the idea of reproduction and to the area of reproduction. And I suppose a lot of it's part of the argument that people have against paid surrogacy and other areas as well, is that, you know, paying someone to give up their reproductive rights is,
yeah,
in a problematic way.
I think as well, it's important to realise it's not just their reproductive capacities that are being commodified, it's also their reproductive rights, and the fundamental right to reproduce is grounded in the basic right to autonomy, which I've spoken a lot about. And so having discussed the importance of this, I think by commodifying reproduction and reproductive rights, we by default also lead to commodification of autonomy, which seems like a pretty dangerous and slippery slope ethically, I think.
And it's linked to this. One of the kind of problems that you might see in this idea of paying an addict money to do something or not do something is that you're almost treating them as someone who can be paid off in various ways. And you might think that, and I think it links to the commodification point and your point about the commodification of autonomy, is that it's quite an unpleasant way to treat a human being by treating them as someone who can be paid off.
So we're not just eradicating the intrinsic value of their capacities or their rights, but themselves as people, I think, it's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, definitely. Great, okay. It's really interesting. I had a few questions about, you know, whether you thought it might make a difference who offers the service. So, you know, let's imagine that Project Prevention becomes a reality in the UK and that people find it attractive, and, you know, I don't know, maybe we have a huge mass problem with addiction, and people think, well, one way of getting around the problems with addiction is by offering something like Project Prevention. Do you think that it would change the sort of moral picture if it was a state-offered service? So imagine that the NHS offered the service rather than a sort of private organization. Do you think that would change anything, morally speaking?
I think that it would be tempting to think that it would, considering that if it was, like you say, it was a massive problem, it might benefit lots of people. But I think when we look back at the fundamentals of what makes it essentially wrong, the fact that the state is funding it rather than a non-profit private organisation, I don't think makes a difference. Another argument I considered aside from the autonomy one was that paying addicts to be sterilised is exploitative because it fails to benefit them as fairness requires. And so although we might say that the addicts benefit from the money that they receive, and so it's mutually beneficial, I argued that it's that benefit actually bestows a false benefit on the addicts. So if we consider it's highly unlikely that people free from the desperation and limits of addiction would view losing their reproductive autonomy as a benefit, despite being paid $300. So I think from that respect, we can say that the $300 can't be seen to benefit addicts as fairness requires and is therefore exploitative. And I don't think that the fact that the state was paying them this money would change that in any way. A better way for the state to address the insufficiency and the problem would be to try and eradicate the vulnerability which makes this exploitation of addicts possible. So like I said before, this $300 would be better spent providing rehabilitation or preventing addiction, rather, which much longer term, more sustainable solution than just preventing the reproduction of a group of addicts.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I suppose, I mean, on one reading, it's actually probably worse for the states to take control of this, because exactly as you say, you know, it's not the state's job to exploit people. Presumably, yeah, exactly. One of the key jobs of the state is to protect people's healthcare and precisely to get them out of a state of addiction.
Yeah.
So, you know, on one reading, it's probably better for, or rather worse for the state to be giving out incentivization for... Mm-hmm. sterilizing addicts, because it just looks like a strange thing for the state to do. One question I had was whether we might defend. I'm sort of right in the last ditch of trying to defend something like prevention. Not that I have any particular stake in the matter, but I'm just sort of hypothetically, let's try and defend it as much as possible. One final argument I wanted to test out was, can we see something like Project Prevention as being analogous to something like a medical trial? So, you know, in the same way as we pay people to take part in medical trials to test out medicine, I mean, a good topical example would be the coronavirus medicine. We pay people to take part in trials. I think in the case of coronavirus, there have been lots of volunteers. But generally speaking, we pay people to take part in trials because it's in the public interest to have good medicines that are well tested and mm-hmm. passed all the regulatory hurdles. Could we say that a similar rationale could be given for Project Prevention, so that it's in the public's interest to have, you know, or to not have children in care, because obviously putting children in care requires a lot of public money and diverts money away from other important services. So could you say it's in the public interest to pay addicts to not have children, in the same way as it's in the public interest to pay people to take part in medical trials? Would that argument have any legs, do you think?
Yeah, so I think that's a good question, and one I did sort of consider quite a lot and thought about when I was writing my dissertation. So I suppose it's analogous in the way that the outcome might benefit the public if you construe that to be a benefit. But I think it sort of comes back to the key combination that I argue makes Project Prevention reprehensible, which is the combination of its clients or addiction and the cash incentive, which necessarily impedes autonomous decision making. And although people in medical trials are paid to be participants, I don't think that this crucial combination exists. So when people are paid to take part in medical trials, they're always undergo a rigorous consent process where it's ensured that their decision to take part in the trial is fully autonomous, and they have to consent to all these different, basically every eventuality. And not only is this process absent in Project Prevention and incentivization of sterilization, it wouldn't be fixed by introducing a consent process either, because the combination of their addiction and the offer of cash incentives would mean that Project Prevention's clients would essentially fail and not be considered able to autonomously consent, even if such a process was present. So I think, unlike paying the participants of medical trials, paying addicts to be sterilized, although it might benefit the state, this would be at the expense of the addict's reproductive autonomy, which, given my arguments about the value of autonomy, I think I believe is still impermissible.
Yeah, no, okay, I'm convinced. brilliant. One question I had is, if you, and I think you've touched on this a little bit in terms of, you know, ways in which the state can better help addicts that don't involve incentivization, but if you were in charge of introducing something like Project Prevention, but you had complete control over how it was run or you know, a similar service, it wouldn't have to be exactly like Project Prevention, how would you sort of design it to perfectly meet some of the challenges that you've raised?
Yeah, so I guess I can make a few suggestions before I go into this research, this kind of area a bit more. But I think that to truly achieve the Project French's claimed aim of benefiting the addicts, they've got to, an intervention would have to prioritise enhancing individual autonomy and alleviating background conditions which increase the addict's vulnerability to be exploited. And I don't actually think such a scheme would look anything like Project Prevention. I think it might include medical rehabilitation for drug addiction, to sort of minimise the autonomy impeding effects of addiction. But I think it would also have to take a really individualised approach and work with addicts to establish their reproductive preferences and empower them to be able to make autonomous decisions. I don't know exactly how these myths might be designed. I think that's probably an area that could be researched a bit further, but I think it would be along those sorts of lines of rehabilitation and empowerment rather than a quick fix and preventing reproduction.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Final question, Georgina. When you were engaging in your research, did you find anything that surprised you?
I was quite surprised when I was looking at the sort of legal regulation of incentivising sterilisation and things. And I discovered that the Human Rights Act only applies to public authorities and private organisations when they perform a public function. So that would be like a private hospital providing NHS care. And this means that organisations like Project Prevention are not legally bound by the Human Rights Act, so they're not required to protect people's fundamental rights. And this means that Project Prevention's impingement of addicts' right to reproduce isn't actually legally prohibited. And that's something I found really quite shocking and quite surprising. And it formed a bit of my suggestion in my implications chapter that we might need to look at reformulating the Human Rights Act to ensure sort of stricter and clearer regulations of these private organisations, which do have a very real potential to infringe human rights.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. Georgina, thank you so much for giving up your time today to talk about your research. It's been really, really interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
And hopefully if you find time in amongst your medical school degree, you may be able to do some further research in the area at some point.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Georgina. And thanks very much to everyone for listening.
The Idea Pod is produced by the Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied Centre at the University of Leeds. Find out more at ahc.leeds.ac.uk/ethics. Music composed and conducted by Josh Armitage.